The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
The virus of radical monetary intervention is now in the political bloodstream. I don't think it's any going back, at least not while the current monetary system remains in place. Even 6 or 7 years ago, nobody was seriously imagining a turn of events such that the Federal Reserve would print up some unimaginable number of commas and zeros preceded by a dollar sign. Was that possible?
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Our guest today, James Grant, we'll bring on here in just a moment, Dave, but I want to talk about his book, The Forgotten Depression. Now, most people have heard about the depression that occurred from 1929 into the 30s, but the depression that actually is probably more instructive as to how we should react to a depression is the huge downturn, the tremendous depression that was relatively short in 1920 to 1921.
That's right. Wholesale prices, consumer prices, farm prices all declined more than in the Great Depression, with the stock market selling off close to 50%.
What's interesting, though, Dave, is the entire downturn, huge deflation, wages fell, unemployment went up, like you said, but the whole thing corrected itself and turned into a great boom after 18 months. In fact, it was probably one of the most instructive times to see creative destruction and then what comes afterwards.
Which makes it a very inconvenient episode for today's era central planners and central bankers who think that actually their job is to manage the business cycle. So the Forgotten Depression, 1921, the crash that cured itself, written by James Grant, is either his 9th or 10th book. And I have to be quite honest here. This is one of those authors which is probably more formative than any other in my library and in terms of my thinking, both as an investor and as someone who's interested in finance and economics. So his book on Bernard Baruch, his book on, you know, Mr. Market Miscalculates just a few years ago. Before that, Mr. Speaker, probably my favorite book going back in time in terms of when he published them, Money of the Mind. But his first book, The Trouble with Prosperity, I could go on and on. He does a great job of looking both at people who were involved in finance, people who were involved in politics, and of course, his monthly contribution, The Interest Rate Observer. He is a bond man. He's interested in the interest rate world, what moves the interest rate market. And today, to be interested in interest rates is really to take an interest in politics, because it is, as he's written many times before, a price mechanism which is controlled, in stark contrast to what was the success story of the 1920s, the price mechanism working on an unfettered basis, on an uncontrolled basis, and that's where the self-healing properties emerged.
Well, and it's interesting, Dave, people are willing to pay a pretty penny for that monthly advice from Jim Grant. You know, to pay about $1,000 for a subscription to a newsletter shows that there's quality, and people are willing to pay that kind of price. I was showing somebody the other day, Jim Grant's Interest Rate Observer, and they sort of shook their head and they said, that can't possibly be interesting. But quite the contrary.
That's what I mean. I mean, my favorite book is where he is discussing basically the history of interest rates in his book, Money of the Mind.
Well, interest rates are the measure of risk. You probably can't measure in a better way the whole social history of man.
And actually, what you just described, the perfect picture of risk, which makes this such a confusing period of time as an investor, where interest rates are manipulated and held at an incredibly low rate, and thus don't give a clear signal in terms of what risk is in the economy and in the marketplace. So you have something of a very fabricated nature.
You and I have talked over and over about price mechanism and the ability for the price mechanism to determine the market and correct itself. That's what this interview is about. Dave, let's go ahead and go to Jim Grant.
Well, as a second-generation Grants reader and regular conference attendee, I want to thank you for joining our weekly conversation. Each book you've released has had something timely and timeless to say. And my personal favorite is Money of the Mind, going back a few years. And I'm grateful you've taken the time in your latest book to discuss the Forgotten Depression, 1921, the crash that cured itself. This has always been curiously ignored. Let's begin with the contrast, if you would, between 1920 and 1921, that depression, and the 1929 to 1933 depression. They highlight a different ideological approach to crisis. Perhaps you can explore that.
Yes, indeed. David, 1920-21 was, on the face of things, well, in the words of contemporaries, it was a debacle without parallel. Commodity prices plunged upwards of 45% over the course of less than a year. The stock market, as measured by the Dow, was sawed in half. Industrial production down approximately by a third from peak to trough. Unemployment was not then calculated officially, but it almost certainly was in the double digits. In short, debacle. The 1929-33 affair proved to be much worse, but it did not match at the beginning the severity of the deflation of 1920-21. The difference in response is most interesting. As you have noted, the federal government's response to the troubles of 1920-21 was, in a nutshell, to do nothing. The still wet behind the ears Federal Reserve Board actually raised rather than reduced interest rates in the face of falling prices. 1929-1930 was a very different story. Then President Herbert Hoover, who had been the Commerce Secretary under President Harding in 1921, but now raised to the White House himself, Hoover resolved not to do nothing, but on the contrary, to intervene with the full power of the bully pulpit at his disposal in the White House. And he called the leading industrialists together and exacted from them a pledge not to reduce wages. Wages had fallen along with prices in 1921. And that was the crystallizing difference, in my opinion. One of the paradoxical sources of strength in the earlier business cycle downturn was the resiliency to the downside, the flexibility to the downside of wages as well as prices, because wages fell not so much, but as they fell, as prices did, the manufacturers' profit margins were not destroyed, but were recouped long about the bottom of the cycle. In 1929-30 and onward, wage rigidity condemned businesses to eviscerated profit margins with the result of much greater unemployment than would have been the result otherwise.
So there is the crux. Labor, they, in that 1929 to 1933 period, were shifting the burden to capital instead of labor versus 1920 to 21. You had that politically unpalatable issue of lowering wages. And the farther we go in history, we see that it becomes even more politically unpalatable. So there is, even by the time of Hoover, the decision to not adjust. We've got the price adjustment. They won't adjust in labor. Rueff and others have pointed out that that is a critical element in recovery.
Yeah.
Now, wage deflation, let's fast forward to the current context, if you would, just a moment, because wage deflation, if that was the key contrast between 20 and 21 and the 1930s, how should we understand labor and wages in the context of, say, the last 6 years?
Yeah, of course, in 1920-21, there was no federal safety net, and one saved or one relied on friends, family, charity, or one did without, but there was nothing like the literally scores of income maintenance programs that the federal government now sponsors, nor was there anything like the great disability industry that exists today. People took the wages on offer, or they didn't work. Now, the labor force then was heavily unionized, much more heavily unionized than today, so it was not prehistoric by any means. You mentioned the French economist Jacques Rueff, who identified wage rigidity as the great incubus that brought low the British economy in the early 20s. And he contended that the dole really was the problem with British stagnation after World War I. Well, if that was the case, certainly we today in America confront a problem, I would say, greater than the Brits did many long years ago. It's a problem. It's also a social choice. We choose to support incomes. We choose to allow people to remain out of the labor force while they reconnoiter and perhaps intellectually retool or get new training. But in any case, we do not force people into the labor market to take wages on offer. It's a very big difference.
Well, if 1920 to 21, as you describe it, was unmanaged or unmedicated, the last encounter between crisis and, say, a laissez-faire response, the financiers and capitalists of that generation were comforted by the market's self-healing mechanisms. And as you've pointed out in your book, they were weaned on the ideas of laissez-faire economics. What has the current generation been weaned on? And would federal passivity have a different effect based on those differing expectations?
Well, the current generation, of course, is weaned on the idea of a proactive and interventionist government response. You know, scarcely, you know, a sparrow shall not fall to earth without the Federal Reserve taking cognizance of that fact and adjusting its dynamic stochastic general equilibrium model to make allowances, or so it seems. I dare say that society today, without preparation, would be certainly taken aback by a decision from on high that the government really ought to abide by Murray Rothbard's advice. Murray Rothbard being the late, great laissez-faire economist who contended the only, mind you, acceptable response to a business cycle downturn was for the government to do nothing. Having been indoctrinated or certainly educated in the tenets of interventionism, I think that pure federal passivity would be a very cold bath, but I think it would be a rather wholesome one. If there is a lesson that comes out of the historical episode I wrote about, perhaps that lesson is that the price mechanism is one of the great social contrivances and is a much more powerful and benevolent mechanism for the ordering of activity and the coordination of activity and the allocation of resources than many people, or perhaps most people, give credit for being.
Well, focusing on the price mechanism really is returning to Adam Smith's unseen hand of the market, for which we've replaced the seen hand of government. In the tradition of FDR, Wilson, Hoover, I mean, there's sort of a cadre of leaders in the United States which have set the current tone. What you're suggesting is that perhaps Harding set the better tone.
Yeah, the results certainly would point in that direction. By the way, it wasn't just Harding. Wilson, the dates of this business cycle downturn are from early 1920 until the summer of 1921. It was over and done with, at least as to the top and the bottom, over and done with in a year and a half. And much of that time was during the last year or so of Woodrow Wilson's second administration. And he was not an apostle of laissez-faire, but was a practitioner of that by dint of the stroke that incapacitated him. The same stroke incapacitated his administration. The White House was really in the hands of his wife, and she, without realizing it, was a practitioner of the doctrines of the classical economists. You know, the government balanced the budget and didn't try to implement anything in the way of stimulus. And so, ironically enough, Woodrow Wilson, who was a great one for statism, also was the great accidental advocate, or at least a practitioner, of laissez-faire.
It's interesting because in your book, there's a difference, perhaps, with most heroic tales. We're looking for a man of action in most heroic tales, and yet in yours, it's the man of inaction that's to be celebrated.
Yes, constructive inaction. We ought to have more of it. The papers would make much more pleasant reading if there were much more constructive inaction, like silences or noise of our governance.
By contrast, we have economists, which today who are assumed to be some sort of engineers, at least the central banks of our day, steering, offering guidance.
Yes, the wise ones.
Let's discuss presumption in economics, because this controlled and guided process has the air of experience to it, and yet we also have the confession of Ben Bernanke, or just the telling acknowledgement that they are learning as they go. How is it that we put so much faith in people orchestrating events at the Fed, at the ECB, at the Bank of Japan?
Beats me. Nobody reads my stuff. That's what it is. One of the miracles of the age. I think that in 50 or 100 years' time, perhaps in 10 months' time, but at some point in the future, when retrospect offers a clearer view of events than the immediate lines of sight do, come that moment of revelation, people will say, "Did you mean to tell me that they, perhaps we, turned over the ship of state to former tenured economics faculty? They did what?" That's what it comes down to. I often think that one of the secrets of success of the Woodrow Wilson and Warren G. Harding episode in the early 20s was the absence of many of the government data with which we are now bombarded almost seems by the minute. Remember a man named Copperthwaite, who was the financial secretary of Hong Kong in the 1960s? I think later Sir John Copperthwaite ruled that he didn't want any confounded macroeconomic data being collected for the colony, lest someone try to employ those statistics in the service of government intervention. And I think the constructive ignorance with which the government would-be policymakers operated in the early 20s was part of the secret of the quick resolution of the troubles of 1920-21.
Is that period, 1920 to 21, ignored by students of political economy?
Yes, it is. And it's still ignored because Amazon's run out of the book. It's an obscure period, and for one reason, for the very fact to which you alluded a few minutes ago, which is that there is no dashing man of action, a kind of a pathetic invalid, is not, except for Gene Smith's book, When Cheering Stopped, is not, I think, regarded as the stuff of heroic historical narrative. Nothing like all the stories and the film clips of the Brains Trust getting on trains and going to Washington to straighten out the affairs of the Republic in 1933. That makes much better historical narrative. So it has been ignored. And I think also, in fairness to the heavy ideological content and political content of historical writing, the free market side of 1920-21 does not fit the conventional view of events. It rather jars with the narrative of the early 1930s. If this 1920-21 affair shook out as I contend it did, then one ought to, one must reappraise the 1930s, which Amity Schlaes did in her book, The Forgotten Man. But that reappraisal would seem to be not on the imminent agenda of our historians.
Well, we have certainly an ideological paradigm today that doesn't match the 1920 and 21 data, and maybe that paradigm is largely informed by Keynes. Transitioning just for a brief moment to inflation and deflation, Keynes' tract on monetary reform argues for the benefits of inflation and the drawbacks of deflation. Are the drawbacks really centered on the over-leveraged, the indebted, and the central planner?
Well, the advantages at which you hinted, the advantages of deflation, I think Keynes rather undersold. And those advantages, Walmart, for one, has built a rather successful business model around, which is everyday low and lower prices. Silicon Valley, too, has taken the idea of lower prices to heart. To me, the fact of the matter is, and the relevant fact of the matter is, that during periods of great technological advance in the past, prices have fallen. They have dwindled. They did so in the final couple of decades of the 19th century, and they certainly did not go up in the 1920s. As recently in America as the early 1960s, and for 12 full months between 1954 and 55, the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, actually showed year-over-year declines, and nobody objected to those. Go back and look at the newspapers in the mid-50s or the early 60s, and there was no talk of deflation, although certainly in the mid-50s, people had a belly full of the real thing only a generation earlier. So you'd expect that if falling prices in the order of 1% or 1.5% year over year were a clear and present danger to the Republic, somebody would have raised his voice, but there was really very little made of it. So I contend that a lot of the talk about deflation is misplaced. And I think what many shoppers want is progress, which is another word for productivity-led lower prices.
The problem with deflation seems that the implicit increase to wages is not taxable. And this circles back around to 1913, where under the Wilson presidency, we had the emergence of two things, not only the Federal Reserve, but the income tax. And it seems that inflation promotes an increase, perpetual increase in taxation. These sort of hand-in-glove measures put in place in 1913 have defined the way forward for central banks.
Yes, although in 1913, don't forget, nobody knew about World War I, at least nobody was talking about it, and the gold standard was still in effect in its classical glory, and there was no thought really about an age of perennially rising prices and therefore steadily progressing bracket creep in the income tax. I dare say it was not a conscious decision by the Wilsonians, but certainly that's the way it's worked out.
Yeah, stable purchasing power. From 1650 to 1930, 1 ounce of gold bought you approximately the same basket of goods. That's astounding. I mean, a basket of commodities from 1650 to 1930 did not really change as it was priced in gold. And so we have this notion of quote-unquote sound money. Is it a reality of modern politics that sound money can't be returned to?
Well, it certainly seemed that way. There was an election in the United States this past fall, and Jeff Bell was a Republican candidate in New Jersey, and he ran against Cory Booker, who was a candidate of no particular distinction. Jeff ran on program of reinstitution of the gold standard and lost by about 20 percentage points. So the idea of significant monetary reform, of restitution of the gold standard in some form of sound money, this idea, I think, is not for this moment politically. And I think the reason is that the PhD standard, which is how we at Grant's Interest Rate Observer refer to the regime in place, the PhD standard has been a great boon to the asset holding portions of the community. The past 5 or 6 years have been a wonderful time if you had access to what has amounted to free money. So Jeff Bell in New Jersey was running against not only Cory Booker, but against the stock market. And it's a very hard thing to do. So I don't know about the future of the politics of sound money, but as to the present, I think it is rather a non-starter. Now, my personal opinion is that a serious monetary reform awaits the implosion of the PhD standard, which I believe will happen. But as I have proved to my readers over the years, I don't know when.
Well, as we wrap up, maybe borrowing from lessons from the past, allowing them to echo into the future, how do you see the long-term outlook for equities, bonds, gold market, the dollar, 5, 7, 10 years out. Again, no one has a crystal ball, but is there anything that we can learn from the past that might shed light on where we go next?
Well, in partial and wholly unsatisfactory answer to that brilliantly cosmic question, David, so here is my pronouncement as to the present day with reference to the past, and that is that the virus of radical monetary intervention is now in the political bloodstream. I don't think there's any going back. At least not while the current monetary system remains in place. Even 6 or 7 years ago, nobody was even really seriously imagining a turn of events such that the Federal Reserve would print up some unimaginable number of commas and zeros preceded by a dollar sign. Was that possible? Well, it happened, and it's happening the world over. And furthermore, not only has it happened, but it is evidently a success in the terms of the central bankers. They point out that there is no inflation. They love to rub the noses of the critics in the fact that at the checkout counter, you cannot see anything gone wrong. Well, we haven't got enough time to enumerate all the things that have gone wrong with this regime, but suffice it to say that it appears to have been a great success in financial engineering. Only the other day, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which is the sponsor of free markets around the world, awarded its, if you please, David, the Financial Innovation Award of 2014, none other than Ben Bernanke, former chairman of the Fed, for his leveraging his historical knowledge into these great deeds of intervention. So it seems to me that the great question, certainly for gold investors, but I dare say for all investors, not just gold investors on second or third thought, bond investors maybe even more so, the great fact is that this precedent is now in the books, on the record. It works, they say they. So the next time there will be a bear market, of course, there will be a recession, of course. The next time, what will they do? What will they do for an encore? And it's likely to be still more audacious because, after all, we have shown, have we not, that audacity is not only what sells, but also what works. So I am a believer in the financial as well as the monetary utility of gold. I think gold will come back into its own in a very big way. And what we try to do at Grants is to look for things that are unloved and assets that are overhyped and to be long and short and hedged and alert and not to make unforced errors, which is something we do every third or fourth year. But I guess that ends my speech on the future.
Well, we appreciate you joining us in today's conversation. And again, from the second generation Grants reader, we appreciate all that you've done going back many, many decades. There was two people that my father gave me as a mandate to read, Alan Abelson and Jim Grant. He said, you don't want to miss these two fine and distinguished gentlemen. Pay attention to what they say. Read them. I think he even said religiously. And I've done that. So I appreciate it and look forward to the next Grants conference. I hope that some of our listeners will also entertain looking at Grants Interest Rate Observer as a regular staple, and certainly the Forgotten Depression, 1921, the crash that cured itself.
David, I thank you. It's been a delight. So long.
Bye-bye.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Jim Grant, the author of The Forgotten Depression. If you'd like to get a copy of that book, which is excellent, get in queue for the back orders already at Amazon.com. Now, you can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call, 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.